طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Today we feature a webinar conversation sponsored by Uncle Bobby's Books between Columbia University historian Rashi Khalidi and Temple University professor Mark Lamont Hill. They discuss Khalidi's latest book, The 100-Year War on Palestine. Mark Lamont begins with introductions.
Finally, welcome everyone to our author event at Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. My name is Mark Lamont Hill. I am the owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books, and I am honored to have with us this evening a brilliant scholar, a world-renowned, and a wonderful writer, and someone who's writing about some of the most important issues in the world, specifically what's happening in Palestine. He's written a series of books, many of which are among my favorites, and that I always learn a great deal when I read his work. He has set the tone and really the scope of modern writing on Palestine. He's one of the most important historians on the subject. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. And his newest book is called The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonial Conquest and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Rashid Khalidi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Nice and easy, too, right? See how easy that was?
I know. Finally.
Yes.
We're good.
So talk to me about this book. First of all, you call the book The 100 Years War on Palestine. Let me say one thing before that, by the way. I'm assuming, judging by the number of people here and some of the names that I recognize, that there will be people in this crowd who know a great deal about Israel-Palestine and who will be interested in the nuances of the book. And there will be people here who are coming here because they're Uncle Bobby's fans and part of the Uncle Bobby's community. And they're interested in this issue and are sympathetic to the politics of it, but don't necessarily have the base. So some of my questions will be in that context, and we can get into some of the weeds as well. But the book is called The 100 Years War on Palestine. There will be people who will say that the Arab-Israeli War of 1948 was 72 years ago, if my math is correct. Why are you calling this a 100-year war on Palestine? What does that mean?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that this starts with the launching of both settler colonialism in the form it took in Palestine, but also of great power intervention in support of that settler colonial project. And so I take it back to the Balfour Declaration of 1917. This did not start with a war in 1948 or a war in 1967. It started with an idea of taking over a country that had an indigenous population, implanting a new population in it, in the interest, in the service of an imperial interest, the imperial interest of Britain. So I'm trying to reframe the whole thing. Some people would say, you know, this is Arab aggression against an innocent group of Jewish refugees from Europe. Others would say it's a tragic conflict between two peoples. Well, now there are two peoples, but once upon a time, there was a people there whose homeland was invaded. And that's what I'm trying to show with this framing.
The framing that you use, though, you talk about this as a settler colonial project, as a settler colonial process, and you use a settler colonial framework. First of all, if you could help us understand what that means and why that's such a bold intervention. And I say bold because 20 years ago, I'm not sure you could publish a book where you say that Israel is a settler colonial project, where you're akin to Australia or the U.S. or wherever. You couldn't do it. So why? First of all, help us understand what you mean when you say Israel is a settler colonial state or a settler colonial project. And why is that a helpful framing as opposed to talking about this as competing national struggles.
Right. Well, there are competing national struggles now. Right. But like other settler colonial conflicts, this one doesn't start with, say, the French and the Germans. This starts with one people's land, as it were, being invaded by another. And you can compare it to Native Americans. You can compare it to Australia. You can compare it to Kenya. You can compare it to Algeria. You have an indigenous population. Great power comes along and implants its own population. Now, obviously, in the case of Zionism, there weren't British subjects, or as in Algeria, French citizens who were being implanted in the colony. The British were allied with the Zionist movement, which was independent and which had its own nationalist objectives. But from the point of view of understanding it, from the point of view of the Palestinians, from, I think, the point of view of the settlers themselves, as they described themselves for the first several decades they were there, this was a colonial project. So you have Zionist leaders from Herzl through Weizmann who write about it as that we're colonists. Of course, they think that the land belongs to them originally, but they see themselves as Europeans colonizing a non-European land. So this is not just, you know, my framing. This was actually their framing for the first several decades of their project.
That project, though, I mean, if we think about that, the project in that context, then we don't just begin with Balfour. I mean, we could go back to the beginning of the first Aliyah, right? If we start there, the conversation could become even more interesting. I mean, could we make the argument the war on Palestine actually begins even maybe 1892? I mean, could we take it even further back?
I actually start the book with a letter written by an ancestor of mine to Theodore Herzl in 1899. So you're absolutely right. It can go back to the late 19th century, which is when modern political Zionism begins. The first Zionist Congress is 1897. This letter is 1899. And you're right, in the 1880s and 1890s, with the first Aliyah, you had the first people fleeing persecution in Europe, Jewish refugees, you can call them, but people who are driven by a national motivation. And so, yes, you could easily take it back to the 1880s, 1890s. And so I quote this letter in which this ancestor of mine says to Herzl, you know, Zionism in principle is an understandable response to anti-Semitism, which is a terrible thing. And the guy who was writing, Yusuf Bielcheldi is his name, had lived for decades in Europe. He had been an ambassador. He'd been a scholar. He knew European anti-Semitism. And he writes about it knowingly to Herzl. He says, but there's a problem. You're coming to a country that's already inhabited and whose population will not agree to be supplanted. Now, you can find similar responses by colonized peoples all over the globe. What do you think you're doing coming here to take this land away from us? Herzl's response is the typical response of a colonist. Oh, we're going to make your lives better. And who would dream of pushing you out? And one of the funny things is, in the original letter, Yusuf Bielcheldi never says, you're going to push us out. Herzl already has a guilty conscience right. in 1899.
So if the first Aliyah begins, I said 1892, I meant 1882, but that period, they're beginning to come. But the argument from the colonial power would be, there's always been a Jewish presence here. And we're not a colony. We're not British. We're not British subjects. We're not British citizens. So, right. so the Zionist pushback is always we're not a settler colony because one, we're not settlers if there's a Jewish presence. And if we understand Jewishness as a national identity, then we're simply going back the whole next year in Jerusalem narrative. And second, we're not part of a colony. How significant an argument is that, and why is it important for us to unpack that?
I mean, you put your finger on three really important things, Mark. The first is that it's true. There is a historic Jewish connection of the Jewish religion to the land of Israel. That's not new. That's hundreds, thousands of years old. That is completely different from modern political Zionism, which says all Jews should live in a Jewish state and that country has to be made a Jewish majority country, even though there's an Arab majority here. Right up until 1948, there's an Arab majority. So next year in Jerusalem does not mean ethnic cleansing. Next year in Jerusalem does not mean we leave these countries which never will accept us and we go and establish a new country. Next year in Jerusalem is a longing for Jerusalem, which many people carried out by going to there and living and studying in Jerusalem or dying there. But it did not mean modern political Zionism. It did not mean a nation state. It did not mean settler colonialism, which, again, the Zionist movement describes itself as a settler colonial movement. The Jewish Colonization Agency is the institution that starts to buy the land. So they're talking about it in terms of colonization. And the last thing to say is, it is true that this is not just a settler colonial project. It is a national project, a successful national project. I mean, you create a nation state in the end. You create a sense of peoplehood, just like the United States. You can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can be a settler colonial project and become a national project.
Right.
Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Nobody denies that these are successful national projects. Are they settler colonial? Of course. Did they engage in ethnic cleansing? Of course. Did they see themselves as colonial? Of course.
The idea of framing this as a war and framing this as a sort of consistent project also presumes a level of intentionality.
Right.
You begin the book with the Balfour Declaration. For those, again, for those who are here who are not sort of students of the Middle East or students of this, the Balfour Declaration is a key communication, we'll just say. A key communication. Was it again?
Key document.
Key document. A very short
statement, whatever, yeah.
Given the stakes of it, right, to be a 67-word document, you know, it has such important stakes for how we understand the future of Palestine and the issue of the region. Can you talk a little bit about what the Balfour Declaration is and why that's an important starting point for understanding this war on Palestine?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I start in 1917. Since I'm not saying that the problem is between Jews and Arabs or between Zionism and Palestinian nationalism, that's become the problem, or a large part of the problem. The problem starts when an imperial power makes a decision that has nothing to do with Jews and Arabs. It makes that decision for strategic reasons. Hmm. And that decision is embodied in the Balfour Declaration, which basically says there is a Jewish people which has national rights in Palestine, whose population is ignored in that declaration except for their civil and religious rights. So one group of people, less than 10% of the population at the time, is told, you have national rights and political rights in this country. The overwhelming majority of the population is told, you are not a people, you are not a nation, we don't even address you. The word Palestine and the Palestinians are not only not addressed in the Balfour Declaration, they're not even mentioned in the mandate for Palestine that the League of Nations gives the British. So I see this as a declaration of war by the British on the Palestinians at the instigation of the Zionists, but it's the British who make the decision. And I look at other similar, what I call declarations of war, which in most cases are either joint American-Israeli or British Zionist, but always involve an international element. I think that's really, really important. This is not just about Jews and Arabs or Israelis and Palestinians. It's also about the great powers and about imperialism and about colonialism. And that's very, very important. That's why I date it to 1917. Zionism existed, as you correctly pointed out, well before that.
What about, I mean, there are people who would argue that the British were far more agnostic on the question of Palestine than you suggest, right? Mm-hmm. That the British weren't intending to wipe out the population. They weren't invested in Zionism. They didn't care who lived on the land. That they wanted, as they say, empire on the cheap. The British goal was simply to control the region, and whoever could have it, whether it's a Hussein McMahon correspondence that's promising it to you, whether it's the Balfour Declaration that implicitly promises it to you. We don't give a whatever, right? Our goal is just to make sure that as British folk, we can control and have an outpost in the Middle East. But your book gives a much more, I think you seem to be making a much more provocative claim that the British did have an investment in this particular project.
They did. They did for two reasons. Philo-Semitism and anti-Semitism. Philo-Semitism in the sense that a lot of British statesmen, a lot of British politicians, were very much influenced by their reading of the Bible. And they thought that, in a sense, the Holy Land belonged to the Jews, and that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land was something that Christians should further. Anti-Semitism in the sense that they wanted them there, not here, i.e. getting refugee Jewish populations to go to Palestine meant that they would not come to Britain or would not come to European countries. And I think the clincher there is that the same man who, in whose name the Balfour Declaration is issued, Lord Balfour, when he's Prime Minister of Great Britain, at the time of the greatest need for Jewish refugees at the turn of the 20th century and all these horrible pogroms are taking place in Europe. And he's at that stage prime minister. He passes the Alien Exclusion Act to prevent Jews from coming to England.
Right.
The same guy who ships them, in effect, to Palestine in 1904 prevents them, 1904, 1905, prevents them from coming to England. So this is why I'm saying both anti-Semitism and philo-Semitism. Finally, there is a strategic element. There's an idea that these people, as Europeans or semi-Europeans, if you're an anti-Semite, as many of them were, these people would do a better job of defending the British strategic interest than ramshackle alliances with a bunch of Arabs. So in other places, the British did depend. You're absolutely right. In other places, through Hussein McMahon and other agreements, they did depend on Arab clients to serve their strategic interests. But they decided in Palestine that they were going to go with the Zionist movement. And that led to a whole series of consequences, mainly for the Palestinians and in favor of the Zionist movement.
You talked about sort of Arab families or Arab power, local Arab power, Arab clients. I don't want to move to the next phase here without addressing. First of all, I mean, this book, more than any book I've ever seen, is quite personal.
Right.
You talk about your family, and of course, again, those who don't know, the Khalidi family is one of the notable families of Palestine. And specifically of Jerusalem. If you're thinking Jerusalem, you see the name Hussein, you see the name Khalidi, you see the name Nashashib. I mean, there's certain names that have a very specific meaning within the Palestinian context, and certainly the Khalidi family is one. Can you talk a little bit about how you use your family, beginning with Yusuf Deir al-Khalidi, and as a through line in many ways to talk about what's happening in Palestine and this war on the Palestinians?
Well, I did this really at the instigation of my son, who's a playwright. And he said, you know, enough already with the boring scholarly books directed at, you know, your colleagues and graduate students and a few experts. I mean, write something that people can read and that's accessible and do it with personal stuff. And I started working. I collected a lot of material that I ended up not using. I used some of it involving other people, other families. But I found that the most personal and the most relatable were things that I myself or my parents or other members of the family or people I didn't even know from my family had been involved in and to which they'd left a record. Now, I say at the very beginning of the book, we were a privileged family. My family suffered. My grandparents lost their home. I had uncles and aunts who lost their homes. But we didn't suffer anything like the overwhelming majority of Palestinians. Majority of Palestinians were driven from their homes in 1948. A majority of the 1.4 million Palestinians lost their homes in 1948. Some of my family did. The point is that through their narratives to which I had access, I was able to tell what I thought was a relatable story. And as I come closer and closer to the present in the book, I talk more and more about my own personal experiences because I met many of these people who have been involved. Yeah. I was there in the Security Council chamber because my dad worked for the UN when the ceasefire resolution in the Golan Heights was passed. And I talk about that in one chapter of the book. I was in Beirut during the siege of 1982. I talk about that from my own personal perspective or things that people told me and that I relate, you know, firsthand. So what I was trying to do was, you know, in keeping with my son's injunction, to make this a book that people can read who are not experts.
Absolutely. And your son is a fine playwright. Tennis and Nablus is actually one of my favorite plays. This is my end. And that play actually takes place during the revolts, the Arab revolts. And so
36-39, exactly.
1936-1939, and from October of 36 until the end of 39, it's a violent resistance, right?
Talk to me
about what the British did. Not just during that revolt, but I think that's an important moment, but we could also think about 22. We could think about sort of all these moments of resistance and all the kind of white papers and policy decisions that come afterward. What did the British do with regard to Arab resistance? Because there's never been a moment where Palestinians have not resisted the occupation and violence and settler colonialism. How did the British respond? Because it's very noteworthy, specifically what you talk about
I think it's a really important point. Firstly, as you said, that the Palestinians continuously resisted. I mean, this is framed as banditry. This is framed as terrorism. These are typical colonial tropes to describe the resistance of an oppressed, colonized people, whether it's settler colonialism or standard colonialism as in India or Egypt or Ghana or wherever. And this is something that the Zionist movement early on recognized it would need. They did not have the numbers. They did not have the guns. They did not have the capacity to defend this rapacious settler colonial movement that was trying to displace and replace the Palestinians. It didn't say it was doing that to them, but we know that they were doing that. They said it privately to themselves. Herzl in his diary says, we're going to spear it, the penniless population across the borders. That was what they were trying to do. And the Palestinians realize it at different stages, and they resist. And the Zionists knew they could not put this resistance down themselves. So the most, in my view, the most farsighted and most honest of the Zionist leaders, a man named Zev Jabotinsky, writes, we can't do this without an iron wall. And what he means is the force, the military power that only the British could provide. And the British provide, as you say, that force at different stages, but most strikingly during this revolt. They bring in 100,000 soldiers and policemen. They bring in veterans of the colonial campaigns where they've tried to crush the Irish and failed, where they've tried to crush the Egyptians and the Indians. They bring in all the expertise that centuries of colonialism have given them, and air power and artillery, and horrific methods, blowing up houses, summary executions in the field without trial. Imprisonment, not just of thousands of people in prison camps, but local imprisonment of whole villages for days at a time while they search their villages or blow them up or whatever. And they have one soldier or policeman to every three adult males. That's how huge the level of repression was. This breaks the back of Palestinian resistance. And it makes it impossible for them to fight effectively later on when Israel is being established in 1947-48, because the British have really smashed the leadership, smashed the military cadres, seized the weapons, exiled many people. My uncle was exiled in 1937. He's not allowed to come back till 1944. Others not allowed to come back till 45, 46. And so I argue in this book that's why you have to understand it as a war on the Palestinians, which is not just being waged by the Zionist movement. Without British bayonets, Zionism could not have been established. The Zionist project could not have been established as successfully as it was or when it was. They did a lot themselves, but they always had friends. I always see them as a settler colonial movement in need of a foreign, you can call it metropole, to support them. And I argue that not just in terms of the British, but later on in terms of the British and the French during the Suez War and afterwards, and in terms of certainly most importantly recently of the United States.
I want to move, because I know I want to make sure we're good with time, but toward the end of that period, at the end of the Arab revolts in 1939, the British are making different decisions. I mean, the British are very pragmatic about what's happening in Palestine, and to some extent, I mean, is there a moment where you would say, when the white papers are coming out and the British are saying, hey, wait a minute, we need to stop immigration here. This is not a religious problem. This is not a religious war. This is a problem of immigration. This is a problem of job access, et cetera, et cetera. Are there moments where the British are no longer waging war against, well, we could reasonably say that the British are not waging war against against the Palestinians, absolutely, and this is just a Zionist project?
Absolutely. That's a good point. And it's a point that many Zionist historians fasten on, because in 1939, the British do an about-face. They do a U-turn. They don't do it because of the brown eyes of the Arabs, and they don't do it because they're anti-Semitic, though many of them were. They do it for the same reasons that they issued the Balfour Declaration. Cold, hard, strategic reasons of national interest. Britain's going into World War II, just as in World War I, it knows it's going to have to fight that war partly in the Middle East. It has been alienating the entire Arab and Muslim world by its massive repression of the Palestinians, which is causing a scandal among Muslims and Hindus in India. It's causing a scandal in the Arab world. They have to change course because they know, first of all, they need the 100,000 troops. I mean, Hitler is now about to invade Poland. They've just made a pact with the Polish government. The Munich has happened. The Sudetenland has been absorbed. War is coming. They cannot be chasing Palestinian guerrillas up and down the hills of Palestine. They cannot afford that. And they cannot afford I cite in the book, and there's a huge body of evidence to this effect, the Viceroy of India and the India office in London are saying, we are losing the loyalty of our Indian Muslims who are so furious at us. And the British Indian Army is made up of Indians. There are British officers, but the entire bulk, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops that the British are going to need and, in fact, fight a large part of World War II with in the desert, in North Africa, and in Burma, are Indians, Indian troops. And so the British do an about-face. They issue, as you say, the white paper. And by that, they say, we're going to limit immigration. We're going to make Palestine independent in 10 years. Implicitly, what they're saying is with an Arab majority, though they never say that. And the Zionists, of course, correctly, I think, see this as a betrayal. But of course, the British never did this because they were Zionists. They never issued the Balfour Declaration because they were Zionists. They issued it because it was in their interest. And they decided that their interest was in a different place in 1939. I'll just continue with one more point on this. A very good Israeli historian by the name of Tom Segev, S-E-G-E-V, in a book called One Palestine Complete, talks about this, I think, more effectively than anybody I've seen, talks about this Israeli illusion that Israel is created as an anti-colonial movement. And what he argues is that without the support of British colonialism, this project could never have been successful, could never have established itself, entrenched itself in the way it did. And that it's true, the British turned against the Zionist movement in 1939, but by that point, they've already done the job that they needed to do in crushing the Palestinians, A, and B, the issue of the Jewish community in Palestine and the Zionist movement have a bigger economy than the Arab economy. They have military forces trained and armed by the British. They have everything they need to defeat the Palestinians and to stand up on their feet as a state. They have been given, through the British mandate of Palestine, all the tools of statehood, elected assembly, a diplomatic service, a control over schools. I mean, everything that a state has, they already had without formal nominal sovereignty. And that they achieved themselves in 1948 with the Declaration of Independence of Israel. But they already had by 1939, when the British do this U-turn and betray them, they already had all the basic prerequisites for a state. And they didn't really need the British, A, because of these things, and B, because they had already realized that the coming powers were the United States and the Soviet Union. David Ben-Gurion, who becomes the first prime minister of Israel, is the most perceptive in this regard. He'd been working in the United States since World War I. He spent several years in the United States during and right after World War I, together with Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, who's the second president of the State of Israel, building up a Zionist movement, building up influence in American politics, such that by 1946 or 47, when President Truman is in office, the Zionist movement is able to get both American and Soviet support. And those are the two powers that push the partition resolution through the General Assembly in November 1947.
Building on what's been talked about, this idea of the agreements, the pushback to all the arguments, of course, is, well, we keep giving you agreements, whether it's Peel, whether it's the UN resolution, whether it's Madrid, which, I mean, the beginnings of Madrid, where you obviously were, Oslo, you know, all the way up to the deal of the century, right? That Palestinians keep getting. What is the role of the deal, or specifically the partition, as a mechanism for at least giving the pretext of good faith in these struggles?
There's two elements here. The first is that, with almost no exceptions, the international powers that are behind these deals, let's take the Balfour Declaration, or let's take the Partition Resolution of 1947, or let's take UN Security Council Resolution 242, pay very little attention to Palestinian wishes or Palestinian rights or the Palestinian right, most importantly, to national self-determination, which both the League of Nations nominally consecrates and which the United Nations Charter formally and clearly espouses. So these things are trampled upon in all of these documents. The Palestinians are the majority of the population in 1948. They should have been given their independence with a large Jewish minority. But the great powers were committed to Zionism, and Zionism was considered more important than the universal principle of self-determination. So every other Arab country gets its independence, nominal or real, except Palestine. because the British are holding Palestine down until the Jewish population becomes a majority. Never does become a majority until the ethnic cleansing of 1948. Notwithstanding that, the international community gives the largest part of Palestine over to the Jewish minority in the partition resolution. And you can go back to the Balfour Declaration, which doesn't even mention the Palestinians, or you can go up to Security Council Resolution 242, which is identical in that respect. The Palestinians are never mentioned in 242, right. Nor are their rights. Nothing. 242 gives the Palestinians absolutely nothing.
Right.
So maybe a resolution.
They don't even get credit. 242 doesn't even ultimately, in sort of real politics, give Palestinians credit for acknowledging the legitimacy of Israel, right? I mean, one of the debates that comes up from 242 and 338 is that Israel's right to exist still has yet to be established. It's not until, you know, much later that those conversations begin. But it's very interesting how it seems that there's a pattern of Palestinians giving and giving and giving. Yasser Arafat eventually acknowledges 242 and 338 the day after the Palestinian Declaration of Independence is made. I mean, they're, Palestinians keep acknowledging Israel. They keep giving. They keep saying they're open. And when I think about the level of commitment that Palestinians you've given, and I look at the sort of Israeli response, right, which is the PLO has the right to be the representative of the Palestinian people. I mean, of the Palestinian people. I mean, it's such small concessions in relation to what Palestinians have given.
Right.
To what extent, and you talk about this in the book very well, I think, to what extent have Palestinians over or underplayed their hand? To what extent is Arab leadership complicit with this war on Palestine?
Well, this is something I talk about a lot in this book and in one of my other books, The Iron Cage.
Right.
I think one of the things that's lacking in many Palestinian versions of the historical narrative is a sufficient degree of self-criticism and an understanding that if you don't understand the mistakes that have been made in the past, you're going to make them again and again and again. And you put your finger, in my view, on a really important mistake or flaw or error that leadership, generation after generation of Palestinian leadership made. They thought they could negotiate their way to a deal. The negotiations are obviously part of any process whereby you resolve something. But you do that from a position of strength, A. And B, you do that on the basis of certain things that you insist are absolutely essential for the final outcome. I mean, that the Palestinians should have the same rights as everybody else in the country, for example. Now, anybody who accepts a deal where some people can come and other people can't come, some people have control of entry and exit, and other people's entry and exit is controlled, that's not a deal.
Not a deal.
That's an imposed diktat shoved down the throat of the defeated by the victors. And unfortunately, the international community has tended to support those kinds of deals. And unfortunately, there have been Palestinian leaderships that have been willing to go along with those kinds of deals, out of the illusion that they could negotiate themselves or negotiate the Palestinians out of a position of weakness. And that's just not the way the world works, unfortunately.
Your fifth declaration is from 1987 to 1995, I believe. So you're taking... Fifth declaration of war.
Yeah.
Right. So you're beginning with the First Intifada and going and taking us through these stages of Oslo.
Right, absolutely.
Is that irreparable damage?
That's a hard question, Mark. What is irreparable damage? No, I don't think it's irreparable damage. I think the Palestinians have lost a lot by squandering the relative victory of the First Intifada, by allowing the PLO leadership to cut the deal that they cut at Oslo, and by the failed Second Intifada, which was, in my view, it involved all kinds of sacrifices. But it was grievously, grievously mistaken in both tactics and aim and method and so on. To some extent, it was a popular explosion for reasons I try and explain. But to some extent, there were really important strategic errors being made. So a lot of damage, I think, has been done to the Palestinian cause by that whole period between the First Intifada, which I describe as one of the Palestinian victories. I mean, the PLO achieved some great victories, especially diplomatic and in terms of discursive victories, winning over people to an idea of Palestine. That's the PLO. The First Intifada did other things that, in my view, involved major advances for the Palestinian cause. And a lot of that, in my view, was squandered subsequently by Oslo and by mistakes that were made in the wake of Oslo. And I see Oslo as a declaration of war on the Palestinians. Oslo does not provide for a Palestinian state. Oslo does not provide for self-determination. Oslo does not provide for Jerusalem as a capital. Oslo says nothing about refugees. How would you trade anything to the Israelis without their giving those basic things in return? I mean, what kind of logic is that? I was involved.
Is that just bad diplomacy? I mean, again, you were. I know you're about to say you were sort of involved in the talks, particularly in Madrid, for like 91 and 93, I believe. And is this just bad negotiating? I'd like to think that I'd almost feel better if there was something nefarious at stake. But is this just too much faith that ultimately the Israeli government or the Israeli state would offer a fair deal, and that Oslo and even the hint of self-governance was enough to make people buy that?
It was delusion and self-deception and bad. And I mean, look, we went to Madrid, and then we were in 10 rounds of negotiations in Washington. And we put forward proposals that would have maybe laid the basis for Palestinian self-determination, which the Israelis would never accept. Nobody in the Palestinian leadership in Tunis, or at least Arafat and most of his colleagues, were willing to accept that this should be the basis of what they should do thereafter. They paid no attention. They violated Madrid and Washington. They disregarded all of the people who were involved. They sent an entirely new group of inept, incompetent, unqualified negotiators who basically accepted to fall into every trap and every pitfall that we had avoided in Washington. I'm being harsh, but I don't think I'm even, frankly, being harsh enough. Israelis had systematically liquidating Palestinian leadership by this stage over 20 years, starting in the 70s. In fact, they've been doing it going back even further. But everybody who could have stood up to Arafat and said to him, no, you can't do this, was already dead, killed mainly by the Israeli intelligence services, and some of them by the intelligence services of hostile Arab countries, Libya, Iraq, and Syria preeminently. So you mentioned the Arab countries. The Arab countries, the Arab states, the Arab governments have almost done nothing to support the Palestinians. The Palestinian cause is supported by Arab populations, but by and large not by their governments. And this is an example of where they were liquidating Palestinian leadership alongside the Israelis in many cases. So there were some terrible decisions, in my view, made. And there are other reasons I talk about in the book.
Absolutely. I just have two more questions for you, because I could talk to you all day, but I'm fascinated by this, obviously. You mentioned the other Arab countries. I want to ask you one more question about that before we just talk quickly about the present day. Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a moment where the understanding of Jordan's role in all of this was almost like a conspiracy theory. It was almost like an urban legend. And the more evidence we get, the more archives we get, the more letters we read, the more insight what wonderful books like yours offer us, the more we understand that Jordan, at least two moments that I can think of, and I'm sure there are more, I'm thinking in 48 and 67, Jordan seemed to have an understanding of what was about to happen, that Jordan in many ways was complicit. And once the Palestinian people make a determination that they don't want to come under full Jordanian rule, Abdullah is essentially like, hey, then you get what you get.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about
that? He said that word to my father.
Yes.
So my father sat me down. He was dying. He sat me down. He said, listen to me. I want to tell you a story. This is what happened to me in 1947. So what you said is essentially what King Abdullah said to my dad in 1947.
Absolutely. And you detail that letter that comment specifically in the book, which I find really powerful. And so in the present moment, just tying that thread together, in the past, Jordan wasn't very helpful. Jordan is no longer a hegemon in the region, right? We look to Saudi Arabia. They're not particularly helpful. The UAE is normalizing relations right now.
Right.
We saw that last week. There are a series of movements in the Middle East that suggest that the Arab states aren't going to be particularly helpful. At best, as you said, you'll get emotional support. You'll get solidarity from the people, but not from the state. At the same time, the British are not largely the reason why. Right. I mean, that's not the right now. It's the United States is a singular power that stabilizes and normalizes this occupation. Oh, I'm sorry. I think you got me now. Basically, to cut it short, it's no longer
the United States. You were saying.
Right. So with the U.S. in this position of power and the Arab states unhelpful, what does Palestine do? What's the, is Palestine friendless at this point? And if so, how do you get to a point? And with the UN essentially, right. How do you get somewhere?
Right. Well, one of the things I do is I look at history. And you look at a time when the Palestinians did not look to the Arab governments. The Arab world is a black hole as far as democracy is concerned, as far as consent of the government is concerned. Well, every other region of the world has seen some movement towards democracy with backsliding. Latin America, Southeast Asia, South Asia, East Europe, Africa, every single region of the world, the non-Arab countries in the Middle East, Turkey, Iran, have a greater degree of democracy, by and large, than the overwhelming majority of Arab countries. So the governments don't represent their people. The peoples we know are supportive. There's a massive public opinion surveying that shows that Arab people basically support the Palestinians, but their governments are more attuned to what Washington wants or what Israel wants than they are to their people. So that's the first point. The second thing that has to be said is that in a situation like this, it's up to the Palestinians to, first of all, unify themselves and get their act together, which I talk about in the book. But having done that, to appeal over the heads of these unrepresentative, undemocratic governments that do not enjoy the consent of the governed to the Arab people. And this is not something that they have not done before. The governments in the Arab world were no different in the 60s and the 70s. They weren't enlightened democracies. And Arab governments were forced by public pressure on undemocratic dictatorial or monarchical regimes to align themselves with the PLO. You do that again. And you do the same kind of thing that the PLO did in the 50s, in the 60s, sorry, in the 60s and the 70s, which is to appeal to progressives, open-minded people, democratically minded people, people who understand national liberation, understand colonialism, the world over, which is something, again, that the PLO and the Palestinians very successfully did for decades and just ceased doing at a certain point. You've got to do that. You've got to understand that if you want people to support you, you have to support them. And that means you don't stand with the government of whatever dictatorship it may be. You stand with the people. And there's a cost to that, obviously. But there's no way that you can get these undemocratic governments on your side. They are in the hands of Washington. Or in the case of the Emirates, they're dying to have Israel protect them.
Right.
These are undemocratic, unrepresentative regimes that are stealing their people's blind and need somebody to protect them, not just from foreign enemies, from their own people. Now, the United States has been doing this very successfully since FDR met with Ibn Saud on the deck of a warship in 1945,
right,
a few weeks before the man dies. It's been doing it, so what are we talking about, 55, 75 years. Israel is now moving in to play that role, protector of potentates, of absolute monarchs. And it's very clear what the Palestinians should do in response.
There's some questions. We have time. We're going to be done in about 5 minutes. We have time for just a couple more questions in the audience here. Here's an interesting one. Have you personally found any limit on degree of academic freedom in studies of Palestine? Dr. Finkelstein's blacklist in the 2000s was indicative of the limit of freedom at that point, but have things gotten better?
That's a really good question. There's enormous pressure, especially on young and untenured scholars, on graduate students and on undergraduates to conform, to refrain from activism, to not speak their mind. People are warned, don't work on this topic, work on that topic. Wait until you get tenure, until you do X, Y, and Z. So that pressure is constant. Now, having said that, I have to say two other things. The first thing is that academia has changed what you can publish. I mean, you made a really good point, Mark. I could never have written this book 30 or 20 years ago. I could never have written it, or it wouldn't have been published. I could have written it. But, you know, Maxime Rodanson wrote a book which said Israel is a settler colonial project in France in the 1960s. You could do that in France. It might be harder today.
Right, ironically, yeah.
But in the United States, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, I would say even into the 2010s, it was a dangerous thing. I mean, I have two colleagues who came under siege when they came up for tenure here at Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
Because of their expressed views and their published work. And so it's not like, you know, it's a bed of roses. But academia has changed. The publishing world has changed. Not the mainstream corporate media, but the media world has changed. And so that's the first thing. You can say things today and you can argue things today. Now they're going to come after you. They'll call you an anti-Semite. They'll sic their legions of well-paid lawyers on you.
In there.
They'll smear you as an anti-Semite. They'll attack you right, left, and center. They have AstroTurf organizations and real organizations with real members. I mean, thousands of members who sincerely believe everything that they're fed. So it's not like, you know, it's going to be an easy path, but it's entirely different than it would have been 20 or 30 years. And the other thing that's changed is the atmosphere on campus has changed.
Mm.
I don't know if I think this is in the book. I describe a Golda Meir coming to Yale when I was an undergraduate. There were four of us, a Sudanese graduate student, a Lebanese American kid, a friend of mine, a white guy, and me, the only people demonstrating. And there were like 1,000 people screaming and yelling for Golda. It was like 500 or 1,000 to 4. But that's not the way it is on campus anymore.
No.
You know, supporters of Palestine can go head to head with supporters of Israel. And, you know, we win votes. The BDS resolutions pass at Brown, at Barnard, at Columbia, at schools all over the country. So that's a different atmosphere. You're not quite so isolated. There's still pressure. And the viciousness of the attack, if anything, has increased. Because in the old days, they had the self-assurance of dominating the narrative. The only narrative was their narrative. The books didn't exist to challenge the narrative. Today, I get new books every single week. Literature, poetry, theater, personal narratives, essays, scholarly work, social science, you name it. And if you want to know, you can know now. And you can challenge all of these lies and all of these myths. It takes work to do it, but it was impossible 40 years ago or 30 years ago or 20 years ago. It's actually much easier today.
My final question is about sort of where you see the future of this. To be honest, I love the book. I didn't leave feeling that you were hopeful.
You didn't feel I was hopeful.
You were sober. It's a very sober sort of read of. I mean, which is where, particularly the conclusion with policy prescriptions and such. There are books that end like, you know, there are books you end and you feel as if liberation is unavoidable, inevitable. You're far more thoughtful and practical than that. I want to leave warm and fuzzy. is there still a party that feels like this victory is inevitable? Or how optimistic are you? How hopeful are you?
Okay. Look, I'm a historian. So I'm not thinking of, you know, 2021. But what I argue at the end of the book, and what I believe, is that project that starts off in the colonial 19th century is completely inappropriate to the 21st century. Trying to set up this kind of exclusivist, narrow, chauvinistic entity, which legally, systematically, constitutionally discriminates, is something that cannot be supported in the long term by democratic open societies. It cannot be. It is simply not compatible. Now, our norms may change. Trump may win. Bolsonaro and those folks may represent the wave of the immediate future, in which case this whole thing is postponed. But I don't think that the ideas that are unleashed in anti-colonial movements or in the French and the Haitian and other revolutions are ultimately not going to triumph. They are going to triumph. I hope it'll be sooner rather than later. As those ideas establish or reestablish themselves, the idea of saying that this is a country in which only Jews have the right to self-determination and Palestinians essentially don't exist except on suffrage is an unsustainable idea. You cannot sell that idea in the long term in the United States. Now, in Trump's America, you can, because those ideas are linked to racist ideas that are integral to the DNA of the United States, and we've been struggling with them the whole history of this country.
Let me push just a little bit as we wrap up, because it was sustainable. I think about, I'm actually just finished a book with Mitchell Plitnick called Except for Palestine, where we talk about the kind of the way that in many ways this is a bipartisan project, right? And that this the Palestine is the issue that even the most progressive minded folk can sometimes, you know, have an entirely different orientation to. When I look at the awfulness of Trump's administration, and I think about moving the embassy, as you know, the Jerusalem Embassy Act is not a product of Trump; it's a product of the Clinton administration, right?
Exactly.
So it's just waivers and waivers and waivers, right? I mean, what we saw, most of the stuff we see, Trump is just a more aggressive iteration of a bipartisan American policy. So because we've seen the expansion of occupation under Clinton from Carter forward, really, what reason?
Right up through Obama.
Right. So, I mean, Obama's most bold act is abstaining, right? So
2 weeks before he leaves office.
Right. He essentially left like a Dear John letter to the UN. I mean, if that's the extent that we have, then I guess I'm a little resistant to the idea that this might be sustainable in Trump's America, but not moving forward, when in every America we've had from Eisenhower forward, we seem to be relatively indifferent to the suffering of Palestinian people. What reason do we have to believe that a Biden or a Harris or a whomever, even a Sanders potentially, would be that much different?
Well, I would disagree with you on Sanders. I agree with you on Biden.
I was being a bit hyperbolic there.
There's a bipartisan project, and it has always been a bipartisan project. And it includes the entire leadership of the Democratic Party, from the Clintons to the Obamas to the Schumers to the Pelosis to the hacks who are maybe going to blow this election because they're so incompetent and they're so unprincipled and they're so unwise. But leave that aside. I don't want to talk American politics here. The good news is the grassroots of the Democratic Party, which is the majority party in the United States under a much disliked candidate, 3 million votes more than Trump. In 2018, 10 million more votes in the midterms than the Republicans. The Democrats are the majority party in the United States, and that's not going to change. It's going to take gerrymandering, Jim Crow, voter suppression, destroying the mail system, and 50 other tricks for that minority to stay in power more than another electoral cycle or another two or three. What's happening inside the Democratic Party is a source of enormous hope. The people we've had elected in New York, or I should say, who've won primaries for the Democratic primaries, Jamal Bowman, what's her name, Mary Newman, who defeated Lipinski in Chicago. And half dozen other people, in addition to people in the party, in addition to Saunders, in addition to several other people in the Senate, they represent the sentiment of the overwhelming majority of the Democratic Party. Now, I know that the party machine despises the people.
Yes.
The Democratic Party machine despises its mass base. But these people are winning at the primary level. Not everywhere, but so far, so good. Those people support Palestinian rights. Those people understand some of the dimensions of this. And I mean, I'm not saying that's going to lead to change in 2022 or 2024 or 2026. But, you know, that is the kind of thing you can actually build on and talk about with some kind of hope. What's happening inside the Jewish community, the alienation from Israel of younger people in the Jewish community, it's a source of enormous hope, the way in which some Protestant churches are waking up. So you have a whole bunch of things happening in American society, against which there are horrible forces, God knows. They may win this election, these people.
Yes.
Through cheating and the kind of stuff that they've been doing, you know, ever since they destroyed Reconstruction. It's the same people doing the same stuff.
Right.
100 and whatever it is years now, 45 years that they've been at it. But that doesn't mean that the march in the direction of the majority finally getting its say can ultimately be stopped.
Well, I got to say, I feel warmer and fuzzier than I did just a few minutes ago.
I wasn't trying to do that, Mark. I was just, you know.
No. But I mean, you raise a good point, and I feel very, very excited that these things are developing. And even the fact that a book like yours is not just on an academic bookshelf being read by the 50 of us who read these books, but being read by thousands of people around the world. And certainly in this country, is a signpost of our progress. It's a signpost of what's possible. So,
around the world,
indeed.
We've got a Korean edition. We got two Chinese editions. We got an Indian edition. We just got a German edition, an Arabic edition.
Wow.
It's going into a third printing here. It's going into paperback 3 months early in the UK. Wow. People are reading it.
People are reading it.
In the pandemic lockdown, people are buying books, and some of them are buying this book.
And this is a hell of a book to buy. This is a hell of a book to buy. Everyone, I encourage you to buy The 100 Years War on Palestine. It's a wonderful book. If you are a specialist in the area, there's so much interesting nuance and detail there. If you're a historian, you'll love the references. If you're new to the subject, it's accessible enough that you can understand the overall kind of project. My teenage daughter was sitting right here with me for most of the talk, and she was taking it in and taking notes because she's fascinated by the subject, and I may have, you know, forced her hand a little bit, indoctrinated her a bit over the years. But I think there's a range of people who can build on this and learn from this book. I encourage everyone, you can click the green button down there and buy the text. Rashid, it's an absolute honor and pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait to do it again. Thank you.
I'm so happy we did this, Mark. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to a conversation between Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi and Temple University professor Mark Lamont Hill, recorded in September of 2020. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم